cowboys went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
This is Larry Kingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we'll conclude reading from H. Allen Day's book, Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee. This was published by Morgan James & Company in New York in 2018. In order to provide some context for the stories that follow, I'm going to read you the introduction. I'm a third-generation Arizonan. Back in 1880, my granddad settled the Lazy Bee Ranch in the Duncan Valley of what would later become eastern Arizona. At the time, Geronimo was running around getting his kicks terrorizing the locals. Family lore has it that granddad had a brush-up with Geronimo while moving some horses from Animas, New Mexico to our ranch headquarters. While camped out overnight, he heard Indians start rustling his horses. He didn't want to confront them because he wanted to live another day, so he hunkered down in his bedroll. The Indians took all the horses and left him his life. When Granddad died, my dad took over managing Lazy Bee. Under his guidance, it became a 200,000-acre high desert ranch straddling the Arizona and New Mexico territories. When my dad retired, I took over managing the ranch. Lazy Bee is so much a part of me that I swear its soil still runs through my blood. Growing up, I probably had the greatest young life of anybody I know. I had a huge playground, and it was all mine, meaning that I had access to every inch of the ranch. I was never bored. An adventure awaited me around every bend. Back then, the deal was, if you thought you were big enough to do something, and I don't care if it was swim across the river, or ride a horse, or climb a windmill, if you thought you were big enough, then just help yourself. Go ahead and do it. And if you weren't big enough, you'd fail and learn something in the process. The only ranch rule, be home by supper. By the time I came along, my parents, I won't say they didn't care. They just didn't pay a lot of attention to what I was doing. I was the youngest of three kids. Da and Mo, which was what my sisters and I called my parents, were spending their energy getting my oldest sister, Sandra, through Stanford University and launching her career. Sandra was 10 years older than I and a superstar from day one. I tell people I have the best job in the world, and that's being Sandra Day O'Connor's brother. She's one of the sweetest, kindest, and biggest people you could ever meet, and always has been someone you could look up to and be inspired by. Well, I came along and didn't quite have those superstar qualities. Don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining one bit. Some kids would feel left out, but I felt that the world was my oyster, and I could do whatever I wanted. Talk about a wild child. I was that. Once in a while, I'd go a little too far, but I'd get reined back real quick. I attended the local high school in Duncan, Arizona, but managed to get kicked out during junior year. I graduated from high school up in El Paso while living with my grandmother. My parents didn't come to my graduation, but then again, they hadn't come to any of my football games in Duncan or other activities in any grade. After graduation, I went home to the ranch and went to work. I never really thought about doing anything else. I loved the ranch. I got about halfway through the summer after high school graduation when my mother got a hold of me one day. "Have you thought about college?" she asked. I said, "No, not really." "Well, would you be interested in college?" I don't know. Never thought about it." "Yeah, okay, I guess so." She wanted to know where I'd like to go. "Well, haven't even thought about it. Where should I go?" "Would you consider the University of Arizona?" She graduated from there in 1925, so she liked the idea. "Okay, sounds all right to me." She said she'd get the papers and get me registered. About the 1st of August, Mo told me that it was almost time to go to college, and I needed to go down to the store and buy some new Levi's and a couple of shirts. So I went down to Duncan and bought some new clothes. Pretty soon, she rounded me up and said, "It's time to go to college." I looked at her. "Where is the University of Arizona?" I didn't know. "It's in Tucson," she replied. I had never been to Tucson. Where is Tucson? She said, get in your car, go to Lordsburg, and turn right. And that's how I went to college. I was on campus for about 10 minutes and decided it was the neatest place I had ever been. So many people, and more pretty girls than I even knew existed in the world. My dad gave me $200 per month, with the understanding that I never was to ask for more. I supplemented the windfall by scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins, playing bridge and poker, and working on the ranch during breaks. I made the dean's list and was scheduled to graduate on time, but I was having so much fun, I applied to law school and was accepted. I sure as hell didn't want to be a lawyer. I'd always planned to go back to the ranch. I just wanted 3 more years at the University of Arizona. Much to my surprise, my parents came to my college graduation. I had my degree for all of 2 minutes when my mother grabbed my arm and said, young man, your father's sick. The ranch is going to hell. Now get over there and go to work. I said, yes, ma'am. I'll be there tomorrow. I managed Lazy Bee for the next 40 years. With no upcoming generations interested in taking over, I sold the ranch in 1994. During my years on Lazy Bee, I had more adventures than I ever could have imagined. You can't do something that long, and in the big way that ranching requires, without learning quite a little about life. So here I am to share those adventures, lessons, and wisdom with you. This is Stitched Up. Healthcare on ranches is sometimes homespun. In our community, the only doctor was Doc Lovett, who wasn't always home. Since the nearest hospital was 60 miles away, we learned to do minor cowboy doctoring. I took the cast off my nephew's arm a few weeks early because it smelled god-awful. I pulled more prickers and thorns from myself and others than I could possibly count. Almost every day, either my foreman or I did veterinary work on our cattle and horses. One day over lunch, Jim Brister came to me saying that his tooth hurt. Would I look into his mouth? I did, and saw a huge cavity in the center of a back molar. I told him that he needed to go to the dentist. He kind of smiled and said, I can handle this. He went to the barn, got a new piece of baling wire, bent it into an L shape, came back to the bunkhouse, went to the stove, and started heating the end of the wire. I sat there drinking coffee. He heated the wire until it got red hot. Then he opened his mouth and inserted it into his cavity. It sizzled and smoked and sweat poured off his brow, but he never flinched. I was having to fight down nausea. He set the wire down and said, that takes care of that, and walked out the door. Hardscrabble cowboys don't go to the dentist for root canals, and sometimes they don't go to the doctor for stitches. Number one and only son was breaking horses as a teenager and decided to mount one bareback. The horse spooked and ran off with him. It ran up to a 6-wire barbed fence and turned back. But number one son didn't turn back and landed with his back in the barbed wire. He came to the house a little later with a ripped and bloody shirt and 2 cuts on his back 1/4 inch deep and about 5 inches long where the barbed wire had done its intended use. I said, Al, you need to go get that stitched up. He said, well, Dad, it's the weekend, and Doc Lovett is probably gone, and I don't want to be hauled to town anyway, so why don't you make some butterfly bandages and use those? I finally agreed. I found a box full of Band-Aids and modified them to a butterfly shape. I put 6 on each cut to hold the cut together. To this day, Al has the scars left to prove it. A few years later, Al was selling desert plants to wholesale nurseries in Phoenix. It was Sunday, and he had taken a load of 705 gallon pots of creosote bushes, triple-decked in the truck, to Phoenix. The old truck we had for that purpose should have been retired years before, but we were still using it. He was halfway back to the ranch that evening when the transmission came unbolted and fell onto the frame. The truck stopped. Al pulled over, crawled under the truck, and found the problem. Fortunately, he also had a couple of bolts in the toolbox that we kept in the cab, so he jacked the transmission into place and tightened the bolts. When he crawled out from under the truck after finishing the job, he stood up, not realizing the driver's door was still open. He gashed his head on the bottom corner of the door. Blood started running everywhere. He got into the truck and drove the final 50 miles with blood dripping onto his shirt and shoulders. When he walked into the house, I didn't know if he was my son or a character from a horror film. He looked so bad. "This one has to be stitched up," I said. "It's too deep and too big." He replied, "Doc Leavitt is out of state on vacation." In a small town, everybody knows everybody's business. "Besides, Dad, I've seen you stitch up a lot of cows and horses. Why don't you just stitch me up?" I didn't really want to, but it was almost midnight, and we were looking at a 60-mile drive to the hospital, and there was no guarantee that a doctor would be on duty. I had several curved needles that I used for sewing up cattle, so I fetched one from the barn, got some dental floss for the stitching material. I sterilized the needle as best I could and shaved around the edge of the cut. I poured a double shot of vodka and told Al to drink it. Then I put 8 of the prettiest stitches in the top of his head. He never flinched or cried out, but I'm sure it was painful. He drove back to college the next day. His girlfriend was a nurse. She looked at the wound and said, "You either need to send your dad to jail for practicing medicine without a license, or send him a blue ribbon because this is a nice job." She took the stitches out later, and they didn't even leave a scar. That was my crowning achievement as a ranch doctor. I never lost a patient, and haven't had one since. And that was H. Allen Day's Stitched Up. This story is Watermelon Thieves. It was August, and Lazy Bee was baking like beans. I was playing Big Uncle Al to 7 kids, my 2 plus 4 nephews and a niece. We had finished a fence job, and it was a slack moment. These kids need some fun, I thought. What entertainment can I cough up? We were near the river, always good for a splash. I remember plenty of times as a kid running into the water to cool off, clothes and all, like the time Rastus and I ran in after eating watermelon. It took about 3 minutes for us to dry. Rastus had taken me on rounds with him to check the cattle, and we'd ended up near a watermelon patch. Rastus asked me if I wanted to get some watermelon. Now, what ranch kid doesn't love watermelon? We walked into the watermelon field, and Rastus grabbed a watermelon big enough to feed him, me, and the entire crew. Or so I thought. When I started to follow him, he stopped. "Get your own melon," he said. "This one's mine." So I picked one as big as my 6-year-old self could handle. We settled in the shade of some cottonwoods, and he pulled out his knife, cut his melon lengthwise, then handed me the knife. I cut my first watermelon right there. We both dug into the heart, the ripe, seedless center. I never had the luxury of eating a whole watermelon by myself, and of course I couldn't. But it sure was fun trying. That's what these kids needed, a watermelon experience, and maybe a juiced-up one at that. "Hey, I've got an idea," I said. "How'd you like to go down near the Gila River, steal a few watermelons, and go eat them under the cottonwoods?" Their screams startled the cows lolling by the fence. Everyone loaded into the pickup, and we bounced over Ranch Road to the watermelon patch. I rented out 20 acres to Andy Jensen, who had planted watermelons on them. "Anytime you want one," he said, "come get 'em." I stopped at the far end of the field, full of beautiful, ripe watermelons. "All right, here's the deal," I said, before letting the kids out of the truck. "The farmer who owns this field is a real mean dude. I hear he loads his shotgun with salt, and if he sees you stealing watermelons, he'll shoot you. 7 sets of eyebrows arched. So we have to be quiet and quick out there. Pick 2 and hightail it back here. With giggles in anticipation, our gang of thieves crept low into the field. All of the kids could heft 1 watermelon under each arm, except for Jay. At 6 years old, he was the youngest and could only manage 1. I made sure everyone had their melons, then pointed to the truck. We started the return trek, juggling the fruit and snickering. I turned around to make sure everyone was in tow. Jay held up the rear. He was a pudgy little thing, and his melon looked to be half his size. We all arrived back and set down our heavy load, except for Jay, still a good 50 feet away, waddling along with his melon. Being the loving uncle, I started shouting encouragement. "Come on, Jay! I see the farmer coming, and he's likely to shoot you, so hurry! Run! Fast!" Jay started to run, but as he did, his pants fell down around his knees, hobbling him. He couldn't pull up his pants without putting down the watermelon, and he couldn't run holding the watermelon. The other kids, quick to catch on, joined in with encouragement. "Here he comes, Jay! Get out of there fast!" Jay waddled a few steps forward. "Hurry, Jay! Just keep running! You can do it!" Suddenly, Jay stopped. A distinct change came over him. It was as if he had concluded, "If I'm caught, I'm caught. I can't do a thing about it." He deliberately set down the watermelon, pulled up his pants, and secured them. Then he picked up the big melon, settled it into his arms, and with great dignity, walked over to the fence where the rest of us were howling with laughter. We carried the watermelons to the cottonwoods by the river. I pulled out my knife and carved mine, showing them where the heart was, and passed the knife around. We ate our hearts out, feeling like we had gotten away with something. I fessed up about the farmer, and we laughed and giggled some more, while sweet pink juice dribbled down our chins. Then we ran down to the river and jumped in with our clothes on. It felt good and cooling, as always. I had a feeling Rastus was looking down at us that day, smiling, a big old slice of watermelon in his hand. And that was Watermelon Thieves. This story is entitled Letty. My wife's grandmother, Letty, was one of the most interesting characters I've ever known. She was born and raised in a polygamist family in one of the Mormon colonies in Chihuahua, Mexico. When the Mormons moved west, one branch migrated to Mexico, where there weren't laws against polygamy. As soon as she turned 14, Letty was married off to an older polygamist man. One night she went to a dance, with or without her husband, she never said. A young man about her age also decided to attend. Letty danced one dance with him. Almost before the song ended, he declared his love for Letty and suggested they run away together. Letty was unhappy that she'd been dealt off to a 50-year-old, so she readily agreed to the proposition. Late that night, the young man scratched on her window. Letty opened it and made her escape. They had won a horse and rode double through the night and into the next day, finally stopping for a few hours in an abandoned ranch shack. Her escape mate cautioned that they could only stay a few hours because folks from the colony would certainly be after them. After their brief rest, they rode almost non-stop to the border at Douglas, Arizona, where they crossed into the United States. They promptly got married and lived happily together for 65 years. Letty had many fascinating tales about her life and was a marvelous storyteller. I would sit at her feet and listen to her talk about the big life she lived. When she was about 8 years old, Pancho Villa and his army invaded her small town and stayed a good while before going on their nefarious way. During this time, Letty's mother had one strict rule that absolutely could not be broken. Letty had to be home by sunset. One afternoon, Letty was playing in a field. When she looked up, She realized that she had about 2 minutes until sunset. She took off running for home as fast as she could go. To get there, she had to run across a board that spanned an irrigation ditch. As she started across the board, she could see Pancho Villa and his bodyguard coming across the board toward her. She didn't care. She was in a race with the sun and was more afraid of her strict mother than she was of the Mexican general. She ran pell-mell onto the bridge and knocked the bodyguard into the water. Pancho Villa roared with laughter. Letty made it home and was not punished. A couple of years later, Pancho Villa returned to dip into the town's supply base. He took beef and apples, horses and cattle, and he left a wounded colonel. The colonel had been wounded for some time and was at death's door. Pancho Villa declared that someone in the house needed to nurse the colonel back to health. He chose Letty. Did he remember her from crossing the board? She was never certain. She told Pancho Villa that she knew nothing about medicine, and furthermore, there was none in the house. Pancho Villa replied that if the colonel didn't heal, it would go very badly on Letty's family. Not knowing what else to do, Letty took some flour and cloth, made a poultice, and put it on the colonel's wound. The colonel fully recovered. Pancho Villa was so impressed that he insisted Letty serve as a nurse in his army. She went, though not willingly. After a year of service, she returned to the colony. Shortly after, she was married off to the older polygamist man. Letty died at the age of 96. The family asked me to speak at her funeral. I was honored by the request because I had such huge respect for Letty and the courageous, loving life she had lived. The funeral was held at a church in Safford, Arizona. Over 100 people attended, including Letty's half-sister, who was also 96. She sat in a front-row chair. At the appropriate time in the service, I stepped up to the front and began speaking. I was about midway through my prepared remarks when Letty's half-sister put her hand over her heart, cried out, "Oh, Letty!" and fell over. When she hit the floor, I knew she was dead. I just knew it. Someone called 911, and the funeral came to a halt. The ambulance arrived and transported Letty's sister to the nearest hospital. Everyone was a bit shaken. I was asked to return to the front of the church and continue speaking. Somehow, I managed to stumble forward with my story. After the service, we all went to the cemetery to bury Letty. As we arrived, word spread that Letty's sister had indeed died. I was honored to have been a very small part of Letty's life and was able to share her life story. But that was the last time I spoke at a funeral. You've heard of people who are so boring they bore you to death? Not wanting further damage weighing on my conscience, I vowed never to give another eulogy. Fortunately for others, I've kept that vow and never intend to break it. And that was Letty. This story is entitled Sylvester and Susie. I've had a lot of animal friends over the years, but two of my favorites were indoor pets. Just thinking about them still makes me smile. During roundup one spring, I noticed a little bird on the ground flopping this way and that. He looked different from a dove or quail, so I got off my horse to take a closer look. I could tell by the downward curve of the beak that the little fellow was a hawk, a baby hawk. Based on its coloring, it looked to be a sparrow hawk. If it lived, it would grow to be the size of a dove. I put the little guy in my glove and put the glove in my shirt pocket. By the time I arrived home, he was pretty bedraggled. My wife Barbara took an instant liking to him. She found some raw meat and fed him, and he gobbled it up like there was no tomorrow. Immediately the two bonded. She named him Sylvester. Sylvester learned that when he squawked, one of us would come running with food. For days he ate ravenously. He came to trust both of us and would hop up on our arm or especially a shoulder and ride around like he was king of the house. He grew rapidly, and before long he was trying to fly. I took over as his flight instructor. We had a big living room, and he would go careening around it and bounce off the walls and the couch. He had more crashes than I ever did. Fortunately, he was never hurt. Soon, he was flying around the living room like it was his own private airport. He was ready for his next lesson, outdoor flight. I took Sylvester outside and let him go. He flew around for a bit, then came screeching back to me. He was a natural. He started taking daily solo flights, some long, some short. After each, he'd land on my shoulder or head and, with much ado, tell me about his adventures of where he'd been and what he'd done. I always knew by the tone of his squawks whether he was happy or unhappy. When he was flying, I could call him, and he'd come over to me like a missile. As he grew, he developed the most vivid green and brown feathers around his neck. He was just beautiful. Sylvester never was house-trained, so that was a bit of a problem. When he sat on my shoulder, he messed up the back of my shirt. But it was a small price to pay for the love and happiness that he brought with him. I built a perch for him on the outdoor porch, which he used as a home base. What he especially liked was to be on top of the huge windmill that was the centerpiece of the ranch. I'd walk out on the porch and call him, and here he'd come. I always had fresh meat in my hand, and he knew what to expect. When Sylvester was about 8 months old, he started leaving for a day or two, then would come back. I knew he was getting ready to shove off for good. I hated the thought. Sure enough, one day, he just up and left. We were his first family, but the time had come for him to find his second one. I like to think he circled the ranch one last time, raised a wing, and flew away. To this day, we still talk about Sylvester and his funny antics and loving personality. The other pet embedded in Day family history is Susie, the dog we had while I was growing up. She was a little, short-legged, barrel-chested dog. She had short white hair and a tail that curled over her back. I think she was a stray that Sandra found on the ranch. Susie was the only dog allowed in the house. These privileges were granted her when I was too young to know that not every dog received special treatment. When she looked at you, you could read the intelligence in her eyes. She fit in our family like a fourth child. Susie loved all the family equally and would always come when called. Every morning, she made it a point to visit each family member in bed and greet him or her with a smile. If you didn't know better, you'd think her smile was a snarl, but it wasn't. She'd pull back her lips, stick out her tongue, and hiss. Susie wasn't spoiled, and never was in the way, yet she was always part of any event in the house. One of her best traits was that she could hear cars coming up the ranch road when they were still several miles away. She'd give a couple of little barks. You could always tell whether it was a stranger or a ranch vehicle by her bark. If we heard a stranger bark, we would say, "Company's coming," and my mother would make a fresh pot of coffee and get ready to receive guests. Susie only had one enemy, the pig we kept down in the corral. Once a day, the pig would visit the back of the bunkhouse to eat the cowboys' table scraps. When that pig took one step out of the corral, Susie would jump up from her nap and have a barking tantrum. I loved having Susie as a companion. I'd take her with me to check the windmills or put out salt licks for the cattle. She loved to come along. I almost always took a .22 rifle to shoot jackrabbits. They ate a lot of grass that I wanted for the cows. Susie would spot the jackrabbits first and would tell me where they were. I'd stop and shoot the rabbit. She'd then jump out of the Jeep and land on her head because her legs were so short. She'd pick herself up and run over to the jackrabbit, shake it to death, then strut back to the Jeep, so proud of herself for being such a great hunter. Sometimes she would get a little blood on her chest or leg, She'd make sure to show me the badge of courage that she earned while shaking that mean rabbit. Susie lived a long and healthy life. When she finally got old and passed, it was one of the saddest days we had on the ranch. I was a senior in high school. Of course, I missed her, terribly. But when I think of her, I don't think of the missing. I think of all the fun we had and feel grateful that she was a part of my life. And that was Sylvester and Susie. Now we will read Beef Jerky. "Hey, Uncle Al, have you started the jerky yet?" My nephew Jay looked at me from across the table. I swallowed my mouthful of Thanksgiving Day turkey, but before I could respond, his brothers chimed in with their requests for the cowboy delicacy. The requests for jerky usually started about Thanksgiving. It's the only Christmas gift I give, and those on my list don't seem to want to wait until then to dig into their present. "Guess I better get on that," I said. Of course, I wouldn't have said anything else. I've been making jerky for way too long to admit it. I learned the trade in middle school from one of the Lazy Bee cowboys. He had a rudimentary process. Slice the beef with a sharp knife, season it with salt and pepper, then loop the long, thin slices over the clothesline to dry in the Arizona sun for 3 or 4 days. The flies would find it, of course, so when the strips came off the line, you were never sure if you were eating pepper or fly specks, but no one much cared. The finished product ended up in a pillowcase propped up on a chair in the bunkhouse. No one could pass by without sticking a hand into that grab bag. The salty, leathery beef tasted especially good on horseback while out on the range driving cattle. If you're supposed to chew your food 30 times, you had to chew that jerky at least 3 times longer. After that cowboy left Lazy Bee, I took over the reins of jerky making. The main house had an oil stove, so rather than hanging the meat on a clothesline, I put it on trays underneath the stove to dry. I started experimenting with different seasonings, teriyaki, then habanero chilies, and hot sauce. I'd throw the seasonings in a pot and let them simmer into a mouth-watering concoction. Every year, the concoction got a little tastier. I put the jerky in baggies for the crew, and during the month of December, we'd all keep a stash in our chaps. When I moved to Tucson, I convinced the meat lab at the University of Arizona to slice and dry the meat for me. I supplied the sweet and salty hot sauce. The interns would dip the meat in it and put the slices in the dehydrator. I started selling the jerky commercially, but after a few years, the endeavor required more time than I wanted to devote to it, so I purchased a commercial slicer and a dehydrator that holds a dozen or so trays. Now, I'm a one-stop, beef jerky-making shop, but only during the Christmas season. It's a gift I make with my own hands, and no one can duplicate it because I've never given away the secret ingredients in the sauce. When I sold Lazy Bee, one of the things I brought with me was my jerky making. Every time I smell that sauce, I'm back on Lazy Bee. The jerky has meaning for me. When Sandra moved to Washington to be a justice on the Supreme Court, she couldn't find any Mexican restaurants there with the right spices in the food. So I sent her a big bag of jerky so she could have the taste of hot sauce. It became an annual ritual. After several years, she reported to me that she always shared it on Fridays with the other justices, some of whom had never tasted jerky. After I heard that, I made a rather large sack and sent it to the court with a note. "My sister tells me that you justices enjoy the beef jerky. As you probably know, cowboys use jerky on long rides. But a little known fact is that by eating jerky, they believe they become smarter. I hope it works for the court." I received an amazing response. This letter was dated January 16, 1997. "Dear Mr. Day, home on the range again. You got us as close to it as you could, anyway, when your big sister delivered the hoard of great beef jerky. We take a lot on this job, and lucky for us, some of it comes from you. The court is unanimous. Many, many thanks from all of us. William Rehnquist, Anthony Kennedy, Stephen Breyer, David Souter, John Paul Stevens, Clarence Thomas, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Antonin Scalia. And that was Beef Jerky. This story is Leaving Lazy Bee. I'd been managing Lazy Bee for close to 40 years. During those 4 decades, I never once considered being anything but a rancher. It was a job I absolutely loved. I had assumed my son or one of my 5 nephews would step up and take the management reins. They all loved Lazy Bee and spent a lot of time there, especially in the summers. I think there's a romantic fantasy that ranch life plays out like a John Wayne movie. Allen Jr. and his cousins knew firsthand the effort required to run a ranch. Now in their 30s and early 40s, most of them had established careers in business, teaching, real estate, and other entrepreneurial endeavors. Only one nephew had chosen the cowboy life. After that nephew graduated from college, he came to work at Lazy Bee. He had learned cowboying at an early age. But he also needed to learn the ranching side of cowboying. I insisted he come up to the office one day a week for a lesson in ranch business. It turned out that administrative duties didn't agree with him. After he left to cowboy on another ranch, I discovered a bunch of neglected paperwork stuffed in his desk drawer. That's when I finally had to admit that the lineage of Lazy Bee managers stopped with me. It was a hard pill to swallow. For months, I agonized about what to do about it. Should I stay at Lazy Bee and hang on as long as I was able? Or should my partners and I sell while I was still capable of doing other things, whatever those things might be? I knew a handful of old ranchers who hung on too long because their kids weren't interested in taking over. They eventually had trouble mounting a horse and couldn't do the horseback work once they did. Angry with their heirs, they became curmudgeons. The last thing I wanted to be was a curmudgeon rancher. I decided to call a meeting at Lazy Bee with my partners, Sandra, Ann, and my cousin Don. I dreaded the meeting. I gave a lot of thought to what I was going to say. I didn't want to tell them that our way of life was evaporating. None of them had walked in my shoes, sat in my office chair, or contemplated the future. To them, the future was all about therapeutic visits to the ranch. While I loved working with my hands and with the livestock, I also had unpleasant tasks, the biggest of which involved dealing with the Bureau of Land Management. 76% of Lazy Bee was federal land that we leased for grazing. During the past 4 decades, the local BLM office had grown from 5 employees to 150. Someone at some level was just dreaming up regulations to make ranching tougher. More than a few of those regulations were downright ridiculous. I'd always maintained good relationships with the BLM, but I no longer enjoyed working with the agency. The day of the partners' meeting, I explained the BLM's ways. Then I described what the prospects were of continuing to own the ranch. The price of the ranch wasn't going to increase because so much of the land was leased. Operating expenses would continue to rise while income would remain static. Every year, I grew older. The clock was ticking. Even though we didn't owe money and made an annual profit, the future didn't look particularly bright. Sandra especially became angry. For about 2 hours, I suffered her slings and arrows. I couldn't blame her. It felt like our heritage and the place that formed us and was important to us was slipping away. She vented. Finally, though unwillingly, she accepted the truth of what I was saying. After further extended discussion, we agreed that the pragmatic answer was to sell Lazy Bee. It had been 110 years since our grandfather settled on the ranch. When the meeting disbanded, the mood was dismal and tearful. We informed the rest of the family. Of course, they were sad, but they accepted the decision. I contacted Fred Baker, the most respected ranch broker in Arizona. He came out to Lazy Bee and spent quite a little time with me on the ranch and in the office. Together, we priced the ranch and packaged the prospectus. Then, we tried to sell it for 2 years. Fred showed it 10 times and had no bids. Most buyers said they weren't looking for such a big ranch. 2 years was a graduate course in discouragement. I went back to square one. I pulled out maps of the ranch and, based on its geography, divided the land into 5 parcels. I offered each parcel for sale, with the stipulation that the outlying parcels had to sell first and headquarters sell last. Buyers soon stepped up with opened checkbooks. Seeing the ranch shrink was spirit-draining. A year later, only the headquarters unit was still for sale. Gary Overman, a rancher from Nevada, came back a bunch of times to look at the headquarters. For years, he owned a ranch in the desert between Las Vegas and the California border. The entire ranch was on government leased land. When the BLM learned that the endangered Mojave tortoises shared the space, the agency proposed taking the land away from Gary and giving it to the tortoises. The ranch appraised at $10 million. The deal was that Congress would appropriate the money to buy the ranch and save the tortoises, and Gary would walk away with $10 million. So Gary, banking on a windfall from the government, secured private financing and purchased the last section of Lazy Bee. Gary was proud of his way of ranching. His definition of success was to squeeze a profit out of the ranch with little regard for the grass and the cattle. He never worked on fences and seldom on wells, and even lived without electricity. He kept overhead so low that all of his sales of calves went into the profit side of the ledger. My definition of success was excess grass and fat cattle. Lazy Bee was an ongoing operation with overhead. I paid attention to fencing, pipelines, and wells, and had cowboys on the payroll, things Gary had no interest in. But no one had anointed me caretaker and teacher of the next generation of management. It was time to let it all go and let the next guy have his turn. That next guy, whether I liked it or not, was Gary. I suddenly felt rudderless. My wife and I would be moving, but where were we supposed to go? I didn't want to move to Phoenix or Denver or El Paso or Albuquerque. My wife Sue didn't like the ranch in South Dakota, so we couldn't move there. Besides, winters up north were mighty cold. The only other place I had lived was Tucson. By default, Tucson became our new home. I was still busy with the South Dakota ranch and also wrapping up details at Lazy Bee, so I told Sue to go buy a house. She said, "I don't know what you like." I said, "I don't either." My only criterion was to buy a house that would be easy to resell. I figured after we lived in town for a bit, we'd know what we liked and what we needed. I was pretty certain our first house wouldn't be our forever house. The dreaded day finally arrived. I turned my mind on autopilot. I loaded furniture and clothes in a trailer that I borrowed from Gary, a trailer that I once owned and sold to him. I cleaned up the empty house. I kept moving. Neither Sandra nor Ann called. Sue was in Tucson getting the new house ready. As the day progressed, it felt more and more surreal. It was as if life was tripping by. I didn't feel connected to any of it. At last, I was packed and ready to leave. Gary asked me where the key was to the front door. "I don't know," I said. "We never had a key." In all the years that I'd lived at Lazy Bee, I never locked the front door. nor had I taken a key out of a car or a pickup. We always left the keys in the console of any vehicle so the next driver didn't have to hunt them down. Right then, I realized that I would need to learn to live in a very different way. I got in my pickup, pointed it down the 8 Mile Ranch Road, and drove away from the only home and lifestyle I had ever known. I wept the entire way down that road and well past Lordsburg. Just before sundown, I arrived at our new Tucson home. I backed the 30-foot horse trailer still covered with manure up to the house and started unloading what furniture I could carry. The next day, I found a homeowners association letter stuck to the front door. Horse trailers are not allowed, it said. The following day, I hung a piece of colorful art over the garage. 2 days later, another HOA letter arrived informing me that I could only hang colorful art on the back of my house. It took me less than a week to figure out where I didn't want to live. Then the biggest change hit with the force of a monsoon cloudburst. During my entire ranching career, I woke up in the morning knowing that the chore list was longer than the hours in the day. Sometimes I wished for a twin. But now, living in town, I only had one thing to do each day, and that was to figure out how to occupy my day. For a week, I bumbled and fumbled around and drove Sue crazy. Adding to my discomfort was my bank account. For the first time in my life, I had a large chunk of change in the bank, and it frightened me something terrible. Ranchers have their money tied up in land, cattle, and equipment. I had managed large assets, but personally never had much cash on hand. If I invested it poorly, it would disappear, leaving me with nothing to show for 40 years of hard work. It was one scary time. At the start of the second week, I decided to go down to Habitat for Humanity and see if I could make myself useful. Turned out nobody was a fix-it guy for the inhabitants of new homes. Habitat loved me. I could speak Spanish. I was a self-starter. And I could fix shit. It didn't take long before I was going around to newly completed houses, my toolbox in hand, replacing circuit breakers, fixing sinks, drip systems, you name it. I was one of two people authorized to use the organization's credit card to buy materials. Every weekday, I worked for Habitat on my own schedule. One thing I did was create a punch list for the foreman in charge of jobs, which could be used to troubleshoot problems prior to people moving in. Nobody had ever created one. Alan Jr. was building houses at the time, and I simply borrowed his punch list. The problems facing new owners began to decrease. After a year, I ended my small but satisfying career. I visited the Lazy Bee 2 or 3 times during the first few years after selling it. Gary let the fences fall down and didn't charge the electric fences. He left all the gates open and let the cows wander. We'd kept meticulous well records about every well, how deep it was, what repairs had been done. There was a log on all 35 wells. When I told Gary that those records would really help him out, he nodded in agreement, but then he tossed them out, all of them. For one thing, he couldn't read and write. For another, he used a well maintenance guy, and we never did. In addition, I strongly urged him not to buy any new cows for 2 years. Right away, he purchased 500 cows. I could see the grass thinning. Talk about having your heart eaten out. Mother Nature dealt him some bad luck. The day I sold that ranch, the rain stopped. It was the start of 5 bad years of rain. After 4 years, Gary's private investor foreclosed on him. I wasn't surprised. That investor still owns the ranch. My passion for the ranch, the horses, the grass, all that was my life, continues. But now, I express that passion through writing, which in turn brings me great joy. While I lived on the ranch, I often thought I was the luckiest guy I know. Leaving that way of life was sad and daunting. But I've come to realize that if I'd allowed my disappointment in ending my ranching and wild horse careers to take over my life, I would have missed the new adventures and the new experiences that continue to land in my lap, just as they always did at Lazy Bee. It's hard to predict what roads we'll end up traveling in life and what lessons we'll learn during our journeys. About the best we can do is sit up straight in the saddle, keep an eye on the trail, learn from the tough times, and be grateful for the good times. For me, the sun no longer rises over the ranch each day, but it rises. When I look out my window, I make sure to say to that new day, "Glad you made it. Count me in on the adventure." And off we go. That was Leaving Lazy Bee. And this is Sunsets. I've come to love much about Tucson. I'm back to living on a bigger chunk of land. Not 2,000 acres, but 8 acres. Enough that my neighbors and I can't yell across the fence to each other. I have season tickets to the University of Arizona's basketball games. Every February, the Old Pueblo, as the town is affectionately called, hosts rodeo days, a 4-day stretch of barrel racing, roping, and bronc and bull riding. Trails for hikers and bikers crisscross through washes and over hills. Golf courses are found on every corner. Then there are the mountains, and margaritas, and mountains of margaritas. But probably my all-time favorite event is something that happens every day of every year. Not mentioned in many travel guides, it comes free of cost. It started long before I was born, and hopefully will continue long after my demise. The sunset. That's what I'm talking about. In Tucson, the sun shines an average of 350 days per year, which means I get to watch the fiery ball sink out of sight in the west almost every day. In fall and winter, when the air is quick to usher out smog and haze, the sun's departure can be spectacular. I've witnessed sunsets in Key West, Florida, and Del Mar, California. I've seen the sun float above the edge of the South Dakota prairie, buoyed by summer's humidity. I cried leaning against the railing of a cruise ship as it entered a volcano crater in the Greek islands, the sun's last rays bouncing off perfectly calm water and chariots of fire echoing off the jutting mountains. I've seen the brilliance of a Santa Fe, New Mexico sunset with the purples, pinks, and peaches that inspired painters like Georgia O'Keeffe. Still, one of my favorite places to watch a sunset is in Tucson, especially on the golf course about 4 miles from my house. If I'm out at the range in late afternoon and hitting the ball well, I'll take a cart out and play 9 holes. On almost every hole, I have a clear view of the western and eastern skies. The course is almost always deserted about then. Somewhere around the 8th hole, the shadows begin to lengthen. I tee off facing west. I have to judge by the feel of the club head hitting the ball whether or not I'm in the fairway because glaring sunlight blinds me. About the time the ball drops into the tin cup, the show begins. A roadrunner dashes into the middle of the fairway and stops. Quail chortle. A coyote calls. Then, the sun throws its rays against the Santa Catalina Mountains, granite and gneiss, turning them a deep pink. For a few still moments, the world feels enormous. Nothing seems as important as being right there, right then. It's as if Mother Nature is calling out for everyone to stop what they're doing and pay attention to what's happening around them. The tops of the mountains hold their rosy hue as their base darkens. Quail bobble into their nests. A lone hawk swoops overhead. I hop in my cart and drive to the 9th tee, the western sky on fire with pink and orange clouds. I've seen hundreds of these desert sunsets, some from the golf course, others from my backyard, or through the windows of my car while driving. Occasionally, I pull over to watch the performance. Sunsets are like snowflakes and fingerprints. No two look exactly alike. But I'll leave their imprint on you and carry you through to the next day. All they require of you is to enjoy. Whether you do that with a smile, or a tear, or both, is up to you. And that was Sunsets. And that concludes our book. I've really enjoyed it. H. Allen Day was part of the generation to grow up on the 200,000-acre Lazy Bee cattle ranch that straddled the high deserts of southern Arizona and New Mexico. The ranching and cowboying life appealed to him so much that after graduating from the University of Arizona, he returned to manage the Lazy Bee for the next 40 years. During his career, he received numerous awards for his dedicated stewardship of the land. In the 1980s, Allen purchased a cattle ranch in Nebraska, followed by a ranch in South Dakota that he named Mustang Meadow Ranch. It became the first government-sponsored sanctuary for unadoptable wild horses. He was the first rancher to develop and successfully use a herd modification training program for cattle and for wild mustangs. He tells his story of working with the Mustangs in his award-winning memoir, The Horse Lover, A Cowboy's Quest to Save the Wild Mustangs. Allen now divides his time between Tucson and Pine Top, Arizona. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. Aye,
if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.